Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Digifest 2016. My name is the Queen. In 1976, I did pull down my nicks. I licked my bum and said, yum yum, it's better than Weetabix. Like most people, I enjoy nothing more than a good laugh. In fact, after I finish recording this message, I intend to crouch down behind my husband Philip's food trough and emit a loud rasp of amusement.
To show you are the greatest games player in Britain. What happened? What went wrong?
Well, I think I've been set up fairly badly here today.
Right. And particular what reason?
I think having a final game where one player owns the game in the machine and one player doesn't isn't in the interests of fair play.
Uh-huh. Okay then, so what you're saying, Dave, is the biggest game of this year. You haven't played much.
It's not released till next year. I'll play it next year when it's released in this country.
Okay, you are a journalist. We can get it on import.
Not a journalist. I'm a marketing manager.
Right, okay then. And you don't have a book coming out about, you know, games or anything like that, no?
About beat-em-ups.
About beat-em-up games. So we're not seeing Sir Grips at all here, Dave, is what you're trying to say.
No, we're not. We're seeing somebody just saying he's been set up.
Okay then. And on that bombshell!
In 1972, a crack commando unit was sent to prison by a military court for a crime they didn't commit. These men promptly escaped from a maximum security stockade to the Los Angeles underground. Today, still wanted by the government, they survive as soldiers of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can hire the A-Team.
Sorry I can't be with you tonight, suckers. But I've been having some trouble with a bunch of local toughs hanging around my house. But pay my problems no heed. It's almost time for things to begin for you. So please, settle into your seats, charge your flashing wands, and switch off all your electronic jibber-jabbers. But remember, stay away from our bins!
Would you like a Zhuzhan? Would you like it fast? Like, in the next couple of minutes. Yeah? Then call me, Zhuzhan Zhan, owner of Zhuzhan Zhan's delicious golden Zhuzhan delivery. I am 100% Zhuzhan man. Seriously, I actually have a psychological condition. I'm sick, so very sick in the head. Here's the Zhuzhan Zhan promise. Call with your order. I will deliver your Zhuzhan in moments. Even if you don't call, I'm still coming over with my Zhuzhans. And I won't take no for an answer. I'll shove my Zhuzhans right through the front door. I'll throw them at your house. Warning, if you see Zhuzhan Zhan near your home, do not approach him. I will only force you to try my Zhuzhans. Zhuzhan Zhan's Zhuzhans taste bad. Taste bad.
What's the matter? House too empty? Why not fill it up with this?
Roaming Thomas.
Hello, I'm Flansy Seabong, and I'd like to talk to you about
Roaming Thomas.
It sounds good, but who or what exactly is Roaming Thomas? You know, when your family's in the hospital suffering from shingles, how your house can get really empty, right? Well, now you can activate Roaming Thomas to move around the empty spaces to give the appearance of a full home again.
Wow!
Let's take a look at the details. Roaming Thomas looks like a gnome. Roaming Thomas seems friendly, but he really isn't at all. Roaming Thomas is just a machine, a little tin guy with no lungs. Activate a Roaming Thomas today and fill your home with his discordant clanks and frenetic behavior. Children, if Roaming Thomas enters your bedroom, do not touch him. His casing can get hot.
Children. Do you like turtles? Do you like elephants? Then you need Totally Turts and Fants, the only magazine that is 100%, 50% turts and 50% fants. It's packed with interviews, puzzles and interesting facts. Wow, fants have four legs. Cool, turts live in my walls. It's totally fantastic. Month by month, Totally Turts and Fants builds into a beautiful partwork that's guaranteed to give you fants in your pants and turts in your skirts. But that's not all. Totally Turts and Fants can be rolled up and used as a trunk or placed upon a child's back like a carapace. And what's more, every time you buy a copy of Totally Turts and Fants, 50p goes straight into my pocket so that I can afford the appropriate corrective surgery which allows me to lay eggs in your daddy's yard. Issue 1, out now.
Hello, my friends. Are you tired of the same old swan colors? Do you wish your swans could be more vibrant and stimulating? Have you ever dreamed of covering a live swan in wet, colorful paint regardless of the consequences? Then you need to try new Swan Paint, the only paint labeled as suitable for use on swans. Alright, Swan Paint is highly toxic, but remember, they're just swans, and they might even like being painted. Swan Paint is available in the following colors: red, brown, yellow, top, Sporan, negative 7, and brown 2.0. What is Swan Paint made of? It's made of paint. Do swans like being painted? That really isn't my problem. Please do not use Swan Paint on the following birds: owls, swan paint, it's swanderly, swanderful, ostriches, hens.
It's begun! It's finally begun! Hello, thank you so much. My name is Chris Coltrane. Thank you so much for coming to DigiFest 2016! It's such a pleasure and an honour to be hosting the Q&A with some of your favourites. I should quickly explain who I am, because none of you know me. I'm Chris, I'm a stand-up comedian, big Digi fan, and despite my haircut, earring and body shape, might have you believe, I am not a racist. Good. It's a lovely surprise, isn't it? Lovely surprise. What a pleasure as well to see so many nerds, clumsy nerds, holding beer around so many expensive and irreplaceable computers. I can't see anything going wrong with this. This is all going to be absolutely fine. Lovely as well to be in this venue that we're clearly squatting. This is lovely. Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure to be breaking the law. Always a pleasure. We're going to bring everyone on in just a second, but just to get a quick gauge of the audience. First of all, if you were here for the morning session and the afternoon session, give me a cheer. Or most people. So if you've just arrived, give me a cheer. But we can't tell the same stories again. We're going to have to make up brand new ones. But that's all right, because we've got a bloody cracking hour and a half where we are going to tell the story of Digitizer, the untold story, unless you've read his website, in which case you know it already. Okay. Let us bring each of them on one at a time. What an absolute joy. First of all, a fantastic and well-respected travel writer who has a brand new book out, The Cyclist Who Went Out in the Cold, Adventures Along the Iron Curtain Trail. But not only that, you will know him as Mr. Hares, the man who wrote for the first 4 years of Digitized. Can we give all of you a love, whoop cheer, clap your hands for Tim Moore? Woo! Second of all, an outstanding broadcaster who no doubt is etched into every single one of our childhood memories, the woman who made gaming cool. You will remember her from Bad Influence and also from her monthly columns on Digitizer. Big round of applause for Violet Berlin! Finally, of course, the man who was there from Digitizer from the start all the way to the very end, unless you include the days that he just didn't bother turning up. You will remember him, of course, from his catchphrases, such as, don't go near my bins, please. Mocking, mocking, mocking. I'm going to cuss you. Patrick Swayze's here. And I'm really jealous of Amiga owners. Ladies and gentlemen, you know him as Mr. Biffo, but let's give a round of applause to the real name, Paul Nurse!
How did you left the gap?
No, it's not my turn.
Absolute joy to be here with all three of you. Tim, I want to start with you.
I'm the only one with a beer.
Sorry?
I'm the only one with a beer.
Well done. Do you want a medal? We can make one. We probably can make one, actually. We're here with all this. There's got to be some medal-making apparatus. If you want a medal at any time for your achievements, you let us know. We'll knock one up.
I will do that.
All right. But I want to start with Tim this time. You are widely credited by Biffo there for being the person that taught Biffo how to write. I wonder with all these people here, if you just sort of want to apologise for that, if you want to sort of take ownership of that. Now is an opportunity, we're all here. Maybe you could
I do apologise, and also it's completely not true. Also, he was, was frankly his thing, really. I mean,
It existed before I got involved, because you were doing the page that was video game related.
But bear in mind, I couldn't play video games and knew nothing about them. I think you
didn't you may have had some input. Didn't you own an Asteroids machine?
I actually did own an Asteroids machine and a missile command machine.
There you go. You see, a gamer.
It was actually Meteors. It was a crap knockoff Asteroids.
Oh, okay. There's me thinking for a minute that you're a gamer of some sort, but no, you had Meteors.
So with that in mind, I want to start with you because my understanding is that you were a journalist already before digitizing. You were working for Teletext, or what was your first job, say, in terms of writing?
I was a freelance writer. I would do anything. I used to work for the Evening Standard. Setting a kind of early on, I got into the idea of talking about stuff I didn't really know. So I was a music journalist for ages.
Oh, really?
And to the extent I would go and interview bands. I remember the band called They Might Be Giants.
Ooh!
And just going to the record company offices and just sitting in this room and these two guys came in and I just sort of shook their hands and they said, sorry, we're just changing the photocopy toner. I wouldn't have recognised these people sitting in the street. So there was a bit of that. So segueing neatly into getting a proper office job. I did apply for a job on Oracle, which then went bust almost immediately, so I never actually got that job. I think because some of the people ended up at Teletext, I think. Anyway, either way, so somebody said, this guy was going to, thank God, I was going to be in charge of the music, the sort of youth stroke music section, which I think was something to do with a bit. Anyway, and then they decided, I think Paul, you suggested.
When you say this guy, who are we talking about there? You pointed over
there. Yeah, this fella here.
Go on.
What? Dave.
There's possibly a lot of people here who don't know who you're pointing to.
It
was you.
It was you.
Remember when you worked at Oracle? Remember those days? Good days.
There was no pointing, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to have led you up the golden path there. There was none of that. Although it was his fault. I think Paul suggested that they should have a kind of video games thing. And even though, on the face of it, the idea of having something as visual as video games being portrayed on something as apparently, until it came into his magic hands, as unvisual as Teletext, seemed ludicrous, really. But we went for it, and so that's how it started.
Yeah, well, certainly understanding now that Paul's behind so many of the graphics that are on Channel 4, I think it's fair to say that Paul did take Teletext graphics.
It was it was quite amazing watching him doing his stuff. Almost like somebody kind of played
art.
It was like sort of like Tetris, art. There was these blocky things you could go brrr, and do a kind of brilliant caricature of somebody in the office having a crap. That was actually one of your files.
That was Paul Goddard, wasn't it? I was going to talk about. Remember Dave when we sent him? I'm interrupting Tim's story. This is going to happen. Anyone who was at the Teletext designers panel will know I have a tendency to do this.
Also, I've forgotten everything, so really.
I'll jog his memory. We had the guy Dave who used to write the music pages. Was it Planet Sound? Yeah, it was Planet Sound. Dave, who was some of you will remember from the designers panel, we used to throw grapes at. What was this designers panel? The people who weren't there are asking. And we used to have an internal kind of mail thing, but that you could kind of call up Teletext page. You sort of had a thing flash at the bottom that said, "Do you remember this?"
I remember doing various things.
Various things.
We would sample the sounds off the games and
there was that. But Dave sat with his back. He had there was a window behind Dave's back, and behind the window was Teletext deputy editor David Staveley.
And so we sent Dave this, my daughter's in the audience, but I'm going to tell this story anyway. sent this internal message. We sort of hit send, and he kind of had a thing pop up. Oh, I've got a message, what's that? And it was a kind of flaccid penis that spelled out the word Dave. The editor was sat behind him. Anyway, that was an early Teletext graphic.
Anyway, I think that was part of the reason why it kind of happened, because he was so quick at doing these graphics. So he was able to do unbelievably good renditions in Teletext of like Sonic, which you saw there, or like Mario or something. And then was, oh, we've done that now, so what else can we do? So it was, and then the silliness began to creep in.
Which brings into the question, because we definitely want to talk about how you started at Teletext, yes. And the fact that you were so good at graphics didn't come from Teletext, it came from Ladbrokes.
Yeah.
So tell us about that. How did that begin? Take us back.
It was my cousin got me the job there. They needed a graphics card. I was only 15 when I started at Ladbrokes Racing. If you've ever been in a betting shop, they have kind of lots of screens. And you could kind of have animation that ran from screen one to screen six, and you could have a horse running across. And that's where Turn of the Worm, any of you remember that I used to do a cartoon called Turn of the Worm on Teletext? Yes, the real on the screen. And it was Turn of the Worm started at Ladbrokes, because I, you know, same as I did at Teletext, I got bored. So I think we first started, there was a golf ball. We had a golf ball at one end of this row of six screens, and a golf club came in, hit the ball, and the ball bounced, and then it went into a hole, and then Turn of the Worm pops out. So not that Turn of the Worm. So from there, it was when I eventually made it to Teletext. It was someone that worked with me at Ladbrokes, who was a flatmate with someone else that worked at Teletext before Teletext went to air.
But you also knew did that stuff at Wembley Stadium. So
I did do that
earlier,
stuff.
And I think, I'm sure you remember, in the same way that I knew nothing about video games or music, you knew nothing about sport, and you were at the Wembley scoreboard, and someone came and said, quick, it's the first one of the Sky TV's first live transfer. He said, quickly, Wembley welcomes Sky Sports. And Paul goes, what? So this huge message goes, Wembley welcomes Guy Sports.
And it was it here, the phone just started, what the hell have you done, huh? that was a funny old job, because I managed to, some of you may know this anecdote, this is the trouble, I've written everything on the website. Now I managed to kind of prematurely end a Brian Adams gig.
Good.
Yeah, because again, I wasn't... But I used to, at Wembley Arena, it was my job to switch the scoreboard on at the end of a gig, yeah, when the music had stopped, and kind of prior to the gig and so on. So I was just sitting reading a book. I was in this funny little booth that had like a window that was about that big, so I'd kind of look out and it was like, oh, the lights have come on. So when the house lights went on, it was my cue to switch on the scoreboard. I thought the house lights had come on, and there was no music playing, and I switched on the scoreboard and everyone buggered off. Turns out it was just kind of the break before the first encore, so kind of everyone went home from that. Apparently he was throwing chairs around backstage, demanding that I be fired.
And you didn't get any repercussions?
No, I remember the guy coming in, like the door burst open, this guy who was, I don't know, some sort of production manager, kind of came in, and he was like, you know, you just really upset Brian Adams. And I remember, I was like, oh.
I think we're starting to see where the seeds were sown for your rebellious nature as digitizer from these early experiences. So then, you learned graphics at Ladbrokes, Wembley Stadium, and then as someone who was a digi fan for many years, it was such a revelation to find out that not only were you not employed specifically to do digitizer, but that also you made so many other graphics as well there that aren't credited. So let's talk about the creation of digitizer then. You were just brought into Teletext to do graphics. How did digitizer come about?
Well, my recollection, I remember Tim being introduced to me as a Teletext resident style guru.
Really?
You were, Karen Reed. Karen Reed, who was the features editor, because you used to wear kind of braces and you had kind of your big Donny Osmond hair, and you were quite trendy. I used to sort of just rock up in a t-shirt and trainers, and you always kind of looked quite well turned out.
Your big blue thorn, your braces. That gives a really misleading impression.
Your big pompadour. You were trendy. And I don't know, I think you, yes, I was introduced to you as Teletext style guru, and you were, I was told that you were doing a games page. I remember coming over to you and saying, oh, you know, we
I
need...
I thought it was your idea.
No, you're already doing it. And I came over to you and I said...
I
And I said, this needs to be expanded to a magazine. He went, oh, yeah, right. You were not interested whatsoever. So I kind of wrote up. And I mean,
okay, all right, this is the bit I now remember.
Yeah. So I wrote up a kind of proposal and sent it to the editors, not thinking that they would put me in. I mean, yeah, my job was the graphics and doing Turn of the Worm. So I sent this and they said, yeah, well, you can write it then with Tim. And so somehow from getting a job as a graphics guy there, I ended up being a games journalist, not knowing how to write. You know, I hadn't written anything since school. And so I aped his style initially.
Did you?
No, well, not initially. Initially, I tried to write my own style and it was like, that's shit. So I'll write like him a bit.
So let's talk about those early days then. What was the pitch for Digi? What did you do? What did you take to the bosses? Tell us about the vision there, if there was any vision.
Well, I wouldn't go as far as calling it a vision. It was a one side of A4 that said, why don't you expand this into a magazine? I just wrote that over and over and over and over. And I think I got a big laugh from the back there. I think I just did. I somehow got some advertising figures about, or some figures about game sales, and because it was just, you know, at the cusp of Sonic the Hedgehog and or Sonic 2 coming out. Do you remember that as well, Sonic 2 Party?
That, yeah.
How you hid the invite from me? You remember that?
Ooh.
You did.
Okay.
You did.
Go on, what's the
it
story?
You told me this is before Teletext had launched. So Tim and I, we weren't mates at this point. And it's been out there.
You weren't mates until you hid the invite from me. Like,
yeah, well, do you know, it probably was, ironically, it probably was the party to the Sonic 2 launch.
Was this Sonic Tuesday?
It was Sonic 2. Were you there? Right, so Fred were there. Why weren't you there?
Possibly. I've got memory problems. It was quite a long time ago, but probably. But we didn't know each other then. So
yeah. Hamleys. Do you remember that? Hamleys Toy Shop.
Oh. No, come back to me. Filtering in.
So it was a big launch at Hamley's Toy Shop for Sonic 2. Sonic 2.
Ask me if I was there.
Were you there, Chris?
No. Were you there?
Yes.
Nice.
That guy.
Did it consist of just wandering around Hamley's with a drink?
Yeah. Well, yeah, except we wandered around touching people. That was our thing.
Sorry.
I think we derailed the train. That little train went around as well.
How did we derail it?
Because it was open, that's why. What a stupid thing to do in a toy shop is they went around all the staircase, a big circular, like model railway, and you just drop coins into the right place.
That rings a bell. We didn't just go up to it and go...
No, it was quite low down.
You had to put some effort in. You wanted to derail that toy train, you really had to work at it.
I must also bring it up. I feel like you can't just so quickly dispose of a sentence like, we went around touching people. Just move on. You definitely need to explain what you mean.
It was this thing that we'd do at parties that, you know, back in the day. I don't know if the games industry does it anymore, whether they have big launches. But back in the day, they do big PR launches. And we just had this thing where, you know, we'd pick a celebrity, such as at the party at Hamley's. It was Right Said Fred and Tucker Jenkins from EastEnders. And we'd stroke them, their back. And then so they turned around and then we'd just be like that, kind of like it wasn't us, and just kind of talking. And we did that at various parties. I remember doing it to Tony Robinson.
That's 12 points, right?
12 points, yeah.
That's a good game.
We dropped a whoopee cushion on John Leslie, didn't we?
All right, so many games were coming out this period, and it was such a sort of, you know, everyone was getting really excited, like, oh my God, like, this is going to, you know, this is the new media, there's so much money, and there was a huge amount of money, so they have these giant launches, and these, like, proper, you know, proper celebs, and John Leslie would turn up, turn up at them, and, you know, and somehow we were, like, you know, became part of this whole thing. It was a really strange time, actually.
You were already in there. Yeah, when did Bad Influence launch?
So that was... Oh, I think it was it 92? So when did Digitizer launch?
January the 1st, 93.
So they were around the same time, right. But I'm not sure if I discovered Digitizer right at the beginning.
No.
But I think it was fairly close to the beginning, because when we first met, it was at ECTS.
Yeah, was it the first?
Was it ECTS?
Would it have been 93? So our first one, I think it was.
Yeah, it was my second one, I think.
Yeah.
So let's bring this in, because I'm not sure when Bad Influence first began, but I think you said earlier that it was it Bad Influence that got you into gaming? No, you were already into gaming, and there was a TV show before that that got you into gaming. And which show was that?
Well, it was a show called Call Q, which was on BSB before it was B Sky B.
Square Reels,
yes. And I'd done a game strand on that, and that had introduced me to gaming. And I'd played loads of games, and that's how I got involved with Bad Influence.
Yeah. So what year was that?
So I was 22. I think it was 92, but it must have been 92. When was Sonic Tuesday?
92. End of 92.
Okay, so I was definitely doing it by then, so I was doing it in 92.
So then I'm interested in, as someone who wasn't working for Digitizer at the time, I'm very interested to know what your memories are of the games industry at the time, specifically to do with journalism. I want to know what the gaming world and the journalism around it were like before Digitizer launched.
It was all about the magazines, basically. So when the people brought a game out, the sort of received wisdom of the games companies was that you got the games journalists in the magazines to play it, and you got good reviews in the magazines, and everything would stem from that. So anything else, anything that wasn't a video game magazine, didn't really count. The TV show I did had a huge audience, but people, they still had real trouble kind of engaging with the games companies. And I think you guys came across the same thing, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Because we weren't kind of in the rat run of what you did as a games PR person. But we did get the invites to the parties, because around that time there was this sudden explosion, this sort of 16-bit explosion in money, and it was kind of more and more people were doing it, and you'd get EastEnders stars turning up at the parties and things. Ducker Jenkins. And so you'd get invited to the parties, and you might get the odd game or press release, but it did feel a bit like being on the outside. And
we were very efficient marketers. We had to do like actual sort of press release and try and sell digitizers, because they weren't selling us the games, were they?
Yeah.
And it took us ages, really.
Yeah, we did it all ourselves, because the teletext didn't really care. Story of the whole thing, isn't it? so we just sent out our own press releases.
Yeah. So we'll come on to that. Definitely, I want to hear exactly about how that worked. But let's talk about just before Digitizer launched, because you started there 4 months before Digitizer launched, and you were updating the site as if it were live, but no one was watching it. Am I right in saying that? So, how long did that last? That period, and was it in that period that you worked out the sense of humour and the style, or did that come later on? Also, sorry, I think we're getting a tiny bit of feedback on some of these mugs. I don't know if there's anything we can do about that. If not, we'll carry on. Doesn't matter, it's quite informal, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it all right? Are you all right with that? No. Oh, shut up, then.
You're tinnitus. Oh, someone's phone.
Oh, who's got a message?
Might be me. Shall I check
it?
Might be me.
Yeah, why not? Yeah, it was me.
We've got ours, so yeah, why not?
That's shocking. Who's Griddle Octopus? Are they here? On Twitter. Griddle Octopus.
Oh yeah, do tweet along with the hashtag BlockParty2016, or don't.
I don't care. Flexible. Oh, Jesse's here.
Hello.
How you doing? Jesse's here.
Yeah.
Jesse's here, everybody. Woo! Jesse! We've got Jesse, we've got that guy, everyone's here. It's all kicking off. So tell us about, I'm very interested in those early months.
Yeah.
So maybe you can just sort of tell us what happened there?
They're probably the months for me that I don't really remember.
Good, you're in a very good company there.
Well, I mean, I don't know, we probably had, I think, about 2 weeks of kind of doing it daily, but I'm sure a lot of those pages ended up getting recycled once we went live. Mm. I mean, the main thing I remember is them trying to get me to work Christmas and me saying no.
Dark times.
There were dark times, yeah. I'd worked Christmas once before when I worked at Ladbrokes.
Hang on, you worked at... Oh, no, but you weren't working in the shop, you were doing the graphics.
Christmas
Day in Ladbrokes would be...
It wasn't a day, but it's still Christmas.
Yeah.
I had to go and eat in McDonald's with a tramp.
I mean, you didn't have to do that. I think that was a little bit
stole my chips.
Did it start off as daily? Because I've got a memory of waiting longer than a day. But
it was at the end that they forced me to make it 3 days a week.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure we'll come on to that.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was daily at the start.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, daily.
But the new one didn't go up bang on midnight, did it?
Yeah.
It did?
Well, I don't know. The thing is, I never watched it. I never read Digitalized. I just did it.
I haven't actually realized.
So when did it update?
I hadn't realized you'd never watched it at home. I used to really enjoy watching it at home.
About 1 a.m. Yeah. 1:30 a.m.
There you go.
Yeah, I knew someone, though. That guy didn't. So what were you asking, Chris?
So really, I'm interested in those very early months and what sort of stuff you were writing, and particularly to do with the comedy, I think.
It was quite by numbers to begin with. Here's a review, here's the game, this is what the levels were like, and the end boss or whatever, and then here's some chips and chips and tea.
I remember the first review that I read that you'd written, and I remember the first thing I wrote was a review of Bart's Nightmare on the Stairs, and I kind of took it to you and went, "Is it good?" Showing my dad a picture of a horse that I'd kind of drawn. And I remember showing it to you, and then you went, "Oh, it's all right." Which is basically your stock response to anything I said to you at that point. "Oh, we got the Sonic 2 tickets yet, Tim?" What are they doing in your drawer? Oh,
I don't know. Anyway. I'm trying to imagine I would have been really excited about going to the Sonic 2 Lord.
You were, but you'd asked your other half.
Uh-huh.
And that was how you explained it to me. Oh, maybe I could ring the PR people to...
She would have slapped Tucker Jenkins in the shoulder.
She was there. We already. Anyway.
I'm really uncovering some terrible scars now. I'm just sorry.
I remember everything.
No.
I don't know. What were we talking about?
We're talking about digitizing.
Where are we?
The
early months. Yeah, I remember showing you this review of Bart's Nightmare, which wasn't very good. And then I remember you reviewing a game, and I remember you starting with the... I don't know how I remember all this, but I do. You started with the phrase, "Yowza, this game's so hot it burn our fingers."
I actually want to just go home now.
Did I really say that?
Yeah.
We've got a lot of people here. I don't know if you want to apologise.
But that's the... And then
Are you sure I said that?
Yeah, you did.
That sounds like something that some editor might have said, do something like this. And I'm going, oh, yeah.
No, okay, you did. And I thought, that's good. He can write. I was really impressed. And then I did this review of Green...
It took me 24 years or something to forget about that.
Yeah, Green John Surfer Dude. That was my first proper review where I did it beginning to end. And that was horrible as well, because it was all like, "Delubidacious, dude. This game is so hard it burnt our surfboard."
Well, that's better, isn't it?
Yeah. No, that's probably not what I said.
That's the great thing about looking back on stuff that was made in the 80s and 90s, is that at the time you thought it was amazing, you look back on it now, and that is garbage. Why is that? Yeah. The levels were so low. And I think we were talking earlier, in an earlier panel, about it is really interesting that, particularly in terms of the comedy, Digi really stands the test of time, I think. If it didn't, I wouldn't be here. But I think it does. There's so much of the sort of stuff that was made in the 90s, and absolutely Bad Influence and Games Master as well. Of course, they look like they're from the 90s, but they feel like they're still watchable and good, whereas there is stuff from the 90s you watch and think, "No, how is this ever even made? This is trash." But that stuff really does, I think, stand the test of time, which I think is a testament to the quality. But
I think we only really know whether it does... Kind of, we've only found that out recently because, you know, we've been able to unearth these archive pages.
Yeah,
I just thought it was rubbish and everyone just kind of had rose-tinted spectacles.
We found loads of Super Page 58 and stuff.
Super Page 58,
I looked and I thought, actually, yeah, this is really, really funny. And it still just made me wee myself, and that was 15 years old.
We did go through a phase again on the pub and reading Man's Daddy Jokes from Super Page 58, which is a website, Super Page 58, that archived digitised. It was the first kind of website that was sort of dedicated to it. Yeah, we were terribly self-indulgent. That was Digitizer again, in a nutshell, wasn't it? The whole thing was terribly self-indulgent.
So I'm kind of interested, though, in this idea that because none of these Digitizer pages were
stored at the time. It's only sort of in retrospect. Presumably, you felt like all of your work... I mean, did you feel like it was disposable? And if you did that have an impact in the way you wrote or the creative process?
Well, it probably had an impact insofar as, like, you know, we've just put in, certainly, like, you know, after we got past the yowza, I'm going to punch Paul in the face type. and we've put this thing through, and it's actually a bit rude. There's a really very, very obvious double entendres in there and other bits and pieces. So actually quickly...
In your endo.
That's right. So let's please pay for 1:30 a.m. when it goes away and we haven't been like fired or sacked or in a suit or something. So yeah, that the ephemeral nature was good from that sense. Yeah. It was quite often there was a shit, is this going to be okay? Are we going to get away with this? But you know.
Yeah, well, we certainly started to throw caution to the wind relatively early on.
So presumably we're up to the point now where you've actually launched, and so there are repercussions.
Almost straight away, actually. Oh, yeah. The teletext wrapped over sick video. Yeah. That appeared very early on.
Really? So when was that? So this was the... remind us which one this was. There was a joke you made about epilepsy?
No, this
right?
was...
was that later
yes,
on?
Yes, it was. It was the epilepsy
I was going to say, I said, yes, it was about that. But no, it was
Banter!
Was it?
Yeah,
it was Street Fighter, and there had been some sort of big tabloid scare story about people playing it so much and the flashing lights and people were having epileptic fits.
Yeah, something. And you started the review, now you two can develop epilepsy.
Yeah. Yowza.
Yeah. Yowza. This game's on, it gave me epilepsy.
Oh, God, I'm not ever going to forget that now.
You're a winning travel writer. Oh, let it go.
No, I'll call it a go call. But that was partly because actually that was because the teletext was owned by the people who owned the Daily Mail, and so News International, who owned the Sun, like had a big downer on. So they would obviously go through everything with a fine tooth comb, trying to sort of.
Worked for the Daily Mail. We've got a lot of people here. Yeah. If you want to apologise for that. Yeah. I mean, we're all here. You can apologise now, and we might forgive you.
Yeah, so they're my mortgage for
10 years.
That's
so interesting, because like as a kid, and I think that there's a lot of people here who are, I'm 34, and there's a lot of people in my generation, you sort of don't even really think that it's owned by people. You sort of, there's the teletext, sort of don't really think that it was owned by a big company. Or even...
Well, it did look like it was done by a load of 11-year-olds in their bedrooms.
That's
certainly
emotionally it was. Wise. I mean, I've not thought about this before, but like, we're going to go for questions very soon. But as well, I've never thought before that as a child, that is sort of the charm of teletext, isn't it? Is that it isn't whiz-bang professional. It is this slightly clumsy, but also obviously incredibly well-made simultaneously... medium, and I think there was a lot of charm in that probably appealed to kids and teens.
It looked so unfunny. It looked like the opposite of funny. Didn't it? So Paul's ability to do utterly surreal drawings in a space about this big was quite a big advantage. But you had like whatever it was, like 80 words or 100 words, and if you could make
that 60, I think. Yeah, once you put the kind of bottom.
And once you realise it, you can't really describe exactly. How can you describe a video game in words? It's very hard to do that. There's no sort of screenshots or anything.
We basically realised we were screwed, didn't we? I think relatively early on, and that there was no way of making it any good as a games magazine. So we just tried to entertain ourselves.
Yeah. Is that true?
Pretty much. I think that was part of it. Yeah, certainly.
And again, like as a comedian myself, I'm very interested in the craft of the jokes. Maybe you might say there wasn't any craft, you just knocked them out, but like I feel like there was, and particularly with sort of the character limit, like I feel now with Twitter, when you write jokes, it really forces you to get to the punch of it. Did you feel that with Digi as well? Like how did the character limit and the sort of physical limit to the page, did that shape the comedy in any way?
Yeah, it had to a degree, because we couldn't go beyond what we had.
Sure.
You know, but literally all we were trying to do was make each other laugh. And often we'd kind of, I'd write something and Tim would kind of refine it. Sometimes it would go back and forth like that. But it was even stuff that didn't get on air, such as attacking that box with a tennis racket, just to upset the guy that wrote Bamboozle. it was just
It was extraordinary that the setup was a really big open plan office, actually probably about the size of this area here, and it was huge, quite large. And because they gave us this gigantic telly, which at the time was like, wow, I've never seen like a telly that, and it was right here, right in front of us. So we were effectively sort of shielded off by this big telly. We were right in the corner. I think basically a lot of people did get really annoyed by us because we spent the whole time. Exactly, we were phoning other people. It wasn't just the sort of silly pictures. You could also, you know, when those Mega Drive games stuff, they allowed you to have this page where you could get all the sounds. It's funny, people like this, the Jungle Book came out. It's below the bed. It's like,
and the sound was on the TV, so the whole office could presumably hear.
It was much more intelligent than classy. Yeah.
Space stealthy. The stupid thing was, they'd be sat across the office. It was the sports guys that we did it to. And it was a bit like when we were in the graveyard the other week. You'll see there's another video yet to come. We'd ring people up in the office and play, it's Baloo the Bear. And, they never know who this is. And then these two idiots in the corner go, and then I remember, what's his name, Trevor, looking over and going, like, what's the point? But we laughed.
Yeah, they really, really hated us.
Everyone hated us. Literally everyone in that office hated us, I think.
Apart from Dave.
Dave didn't. Dave didn't hate us, because...
It must have been quite annoying. Apart from the fact that we were just disrupting their serious journalistic lifestyle by being stupid, it became apparent over the years that actually of all the feature sections there, ours was by some massive margin the most popular.
How did they even tell that? Like, how do you get ratings?
I don't know. They had some sort of science. I really do think it was.
Because I always thought Ted Tech was magic, but now I'm here and I see it's actually science. That's quite a fine thing for me.
That's all it is.
So we've launched Digitizer now. It's a thing. It's live. Talk us through, if there is such a thing, a typical day at Digitizer.
Well, I used to actually, the big giveaway for me was when I was telling my wife about things that happened, I would say, oh, it's a really funny thing happened at school today. Oops. and I did that. It felt like going to school and pissing about in the corner of the classroom or something. So there was, the only fixed item in the day was that Friday, once every month on a Friday.
Yeah.
We were given by the nice old editor, when the wanky new editor came in, this was like stamped out, he would literally go, he'd give us a crisp £20 note and say, go up to Trocadero and play video games. I'm 29 years old, but anyway. There was no real routine.
There was no real routine. We had to get the stuff done in the morning and then we'd just fart around, wouldn't we, for the rest of the day.
What did that involve? Just sort of pranks and mayhem, or was there any creative output?
Sometimes. But yeah, do you know what? I don't remember kind of just pissing around all day. I think we were working most of the day, but in between the bits of working, we were messing about. I mean, as time wore on that I was at Teletext, I was there less and less because it was like an hour and a half commute, and I used to kind of... Originally, when I started, I used to sort of leave at 6 a.m. from home, and then I'd be in at 8. Then eventually, I just thought, what's the point? I've got the work done, and I used to just kind of start turning up at kind of like half 10, half 11. But I used to come up the fire escape, so thinking stupidly, because there were these cubicles with kind of sort of chest height partitions, and I used to just kind of drag my coat behind me so no one could see that I had my coat with me. It was really pathetic. But
I love it when you've been in office for so long that you know those strats, so that you can sneak in and no one will notice. If I put my bag down there, then it will be under everyone's desk, so no one will see.
I was dragging his coat and bag behind him.
Did you used to play the games to review in the office or at home or
sometimes.
A mixture?
Not often.
We did. There were certain games that we actually just started because I think we remember playing Super Bowl Man quite a lot, that sort of
thing. Yeah, Super Bowl Man, Micro Machines, which you were in.
Yeah, we've got a hell of a lot of Micro Machines.
A hell of a lot of Micro Machines. And Championship Manager, where I think we were... Someone came over to reprimand us one time and we'd changed all the names to things like Stink Penis. That was Karen Reid, came over to have a go, and we were sitting there playing Championship Manager with this on the screen laughing because it was telling us that Stink Penis had passed to, Brown Vicar or something. Good times.
So as well as that, and I don't know whether this counts as the typical day, but this is where we bring Violet into the story, you got to go to a lot of PR launches, and it just sounds like a dream. It sounds like you played games, you wrote jokes, you mucked about in the office, then you went out for free beers,
yep.
and then you went home. Is that reflective of the reality?
Yeah,
of
that was it.
I mean, and they'll even send us abroad occasionally. We get like these. There's so much money washing around then.
You always got us the overseas trips.
Yeah, and they were always completely fluky. So, should we do the when we met first? Yeah. That's where it started.
Do you want to do that?
So,
yes.
And we're going to jump through trips.
Chris wants to do it.
Okay, let's do it.
I've gone shy. So, folks. So, yeah, cool. Tell us the story. So, I believe it was at a PR... function.
No, well, it was at ECTS, which is what they had before
E3. What was ECTS?
The European Computer Trade Show.
It's the British version.
Yeah, it was a British. It came before E3, and it became before some other big game show. It was where all the games got showed every September or something, and it was a very kind of the sort of nascent, you know, kind of big game show that everyone would just be at now reporting on YouTube.
Was it in Birmingham?
No, it was in London, Olympia. Business Design Centre in London.
Started, Islington first.
It was Islington, And then it got too big to be there. But I had discovered Digitizer and absolutely was this enormous fan of it. And I used to just wonder, as many people probably did, so much about who was writing this stuff, you know. How did it come to be on Teletext? And, you know, because it was such a juxtaposition, it was such a weird contrast with everything else in that medium, and so funny and so mysterious. And I was dying to know, and I've been to quite a few PR events, possibly Sonic Tuesday and all the rest of it, and had not known who they were, so I couldn't sort of distinguish them from the other games journalists. So I decided that the only way to discover who was doing this and to meet my heroes, actually...
was to climb inside your television set.
Close. Very close. It was something like that, wasn't it?
So
was
it a television
set? Something like that. It wasn't a television set, it was a computer monitor. No, there's nothing like that. You arranged a bit of a ECTS.
No, I arranged... I got a PR person from Nintendo's company to arrange... tell you guys that... Do you remember this?
Yeah,
that the only timing they had for a meeting with you was the slot after they had met me.
But he balls that up because he said... he kind of went, and we...
So you turned up, and then he kind of went, "Where's Violet Berlin?" or something like that. But I was hiding behind the television.
Well, he said, "You're going to meet Violet Berlin." Oh, I see. So you didn't. They must be in here.
So I just wanted to meet you. So I had already got there early and was hiding behind a television. Don't you remember this?
I don't really remember you hiding. I'm sure I remember the TV's Violet Berlin lurking behind a television. Because my memory of it is that the Nintendo guy kind of went, now you're going to meet Violet Berlin. And my thought of it was, you're doing PR. They've hired you. You know, we thought you were just...
Yeah, you were completely... You were completely cynical. And I... was quite cross with a PR guy who was supposed to be quite cool, and I was meant to just walk out from behind his television.
Oh, hello. Hello, Tim and Paul.
You do Digitizer. Oh, I watch that. And he just completely... And then it all kind of came out, and then I just admitted it, but you still thought that I was a Nintendo PR stooge was trying to get you to review...
We were so completely out of the loop with all these things. We were not part of any of the whole sort of, clique of magazine journalists or PR people or anything, so we tend to get these things and just...
be in our own little bubble.
Yeah,
be really?
Incredibly adolescent and immature and just sort of from be outside looking in and laughing at everyone. So sorry about that.
But also, you didn't know how... I don't think you realised how popular... You can't have realised how popular Digitizer was and how people who liked it really took it to heart.
We were completely in our own bubble. Yeah. Even right to the end, I didn't really get a sense. We used to get the viewing figures in, but even that, it was all kind of abstract.
I suppose so, when the numbers are so big, you sort of can't. If he was like 10,000 people, you go, wow. But when it's like 1.7 million,
I remember doing that when I put doing those press releases, thinking like, digitized and watched by 1.7 million. I'm not always going to believe this. What am I doing?
And, and Mean Machines didn't. And insulted us.
Well, which brings back to another question I want to ask you, Val. You've sort of brought it up already, so let's go with that. I'm very interested to know what your understanding of what the industry's opinion of Digitizer was, as someone from the outside. Like, you loved it, of course, and you were corrected. But were there any, what do you know what everyone else's opinion was? It sort of widely loved, or was it a controversial thing?
It was just, and like I said before, anything that was not in a video game magazine, written, you know, in a two-page review or preview or whatever was the template of how people expected video game coverage to be. Anything that wasn't in that and in this circle of games journalists just didn't really count. So in the same way, like TV, I mean, I felt like an outsider as well to a certain extent, and I think you never realised that I saw in what you were doing this sort of outsider-ness.
But you always otherness. Sort of were quite friendly with everyone, and we were always quite antisocial.
Yeah, but I think that the thing is that because I was on television, like everybody recognised me, it didn't mean that I did get more, you know, press releases or games or invites or whatever because people recognised me on television. But it didn't mean that I was still part of that, you know, that sort of that coverage that I still wasn't in that circle of all the kind of cliquey kind of games journalists and so forth. I didn't feel it, certainly. Yeah. And also, I was like the only girl in any of the... woman. In any of these conferences and things, pretty much, apart from people who were working for companies. So that makes you feel a bit of an outsider as well.
Yeah.
You know? I like the idea, and I think probably a lot of the people in the audience could relate to this. I certainly can. That even within a group of outsiders, which is nerds that like games, you felt like an outsider... from the outsiders. So I can definitely connect with that quite a lot.
With
which I guess is why...
outsider.
It can get very meta. Who's the most outsider? Yeah. It's very nice to be around people where you don't have to pretend to like sport. It's good. You can sort of relax in a safe space. I like it. So presumably that is why... Because one of the things I was going to ask is, like, was the industry's opinion of Digi something that made you want to write for them more or less? But actually it just sounds like you both sort of felt like outsiders because... print media was the main thing, you're about outside that, so I guess that was why...
I don't think that the people that I spoke to, or just, you know, it's a long time ago, but my main memory is just that it kind of Digitizer was kind of invisible, pretty much, to a lot of the industry, I would say. And because it wasn't a games magazine they could take to their boss with a photocopy and say, look, we got this much coverage. You know, it's just the way it worked. And so, and I think we benefited from that as well, though, in a way.
Exactly. We could, if a game was shit, we could just say this is shit.
Yeah.
Which other magazines couldn't. And you couldn't. They couldn't do that.
That stood out.
We had a much, much more independence in that regard, which was great, really.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's weird though. Going back over some of the reviews for the quiz nonsense that's coming up.
Spoilers.
Spoilers. It's fine. That's the least of the spoilers. I was surprised, actually, how high we rated some of the games. It really, some really crap games we gave quite high scores to. So we've got this reputation for being, probably because we gave occasional games, probably because we didn't like the PR person.
That's the best way of doing it. That's true journalism, isn't it?
Yeah. Sonic 2. No, was it Sonic 3, 72%? That was a famous one. So maybe it was that. I don't know. The game is that reputation.
So, which sort of leads us on to, from the early days, the Digitizer was billed as console and PC, and there's a particular machine that is missing from that list. Tell us why that came about, because it wasn't actually it didn't start with a hatred of the Amiga. No. There was actually just a more practical reason, I believe.
Yes.
Tell us all about that.
We didn't have an Amiga. So we didn't have one to review games on. But,
at some point, we did have an Amiga.
We did, And I Keebus, Mr. Cheese, Adam Keeble, he had an Amiga. So I think he did some early review.
I think, you know what, they
gave
400 quid to buy a bloody Amiga.
Eventually they did, because I remember...
How much did it cost?
£399.
Yeah, they did buy us one. Now, but that was probably about the only... of support they ever showed us, Teletext.
Basically, it's because our predecessor on Oracle had been very heavily Amiga based, hadn't it? And that's what. So the people that had made the transition were expecting it to be a continuation of that, and then
it wasn't. Man's daddy jokes as well.
Yes.
We weren't quite safe.
So yeah. So there was no. But I think we initially, the very first day, we said more or less that we're going to cover the consoles. Mm. We weren't even covering the PC. No PC owners complained. Just the bloody Amiga owners just like flooded us from day one. I think we even had phone calls in that first week of Amiga owners demanding that we.
I mean, the letters went on for years. Years and years. I mean, extraordinary.
I mean, it's so weird that they would care. Like, if you've got a magazine, then just don't worry about it, isn't it? But, like, they were furious.
Yeah.
Can you imagine being that furious? I mean, let's gauge the audience. It's in the past. We can all confess now. Hands up if you are an Amiga owner. You're not leaving here alive.
Yeah. That's going to be interesting later.
The thing was, I was always quite a fan of the Amiga, but Paul just, you know.
I believe it was me.
Wiped up and down the back of the truck and everything, the whole lot,
all of that. They've seen the video on YouTube.
I've never liked the Amiga, and I'll have you all in a fight. That's a lie, I really liked it. My friend had one, it was good.
Good.
Good for him.
The Amiga CD32, however, come on, surely even the Amiga owners thought that was shite.
There is one behind there, actually. You've probably seen all the consoles you can play. And there is, I've never played a CD32. But what were they thinking with that controller?
I don't know.
It's garbage. Surely there's someone at some point went, no, this is a piece of trash.
So we're all on safe ground. We can slag off the CD32, sounds like. That's
like the DMZ for the Amiga. So, you, Tim, were there for 4 years. And just before we come on to the end of that, again, I want to come back to the comedy, which is obviously something that I'm very interested in. Were there any particular characters that came out of that time that were then long-running? And did it come from you, Tim, or you, Paul? And particularly, how did you collaborate? Were there any sort of collaborative works that came out of that?
Characters were all him, really.
Oh, really?
In fact, almost everything was him.
That's not true.
Well, it kind of is true. Apart from the arts, my only contribution graphics-wise, I got really excited when I could do that, as I was saying earlier. Like, I could work out how to do the reveals. It was really easy. So I just went to town, like, cut and pasted those stupid things and put them all over the page. But
Massive ease,
exactly.
And let's talk then about, obviously, the humour was very subversive and always pushing the limits. And it seems not even to be dangerous on TV, but just to amuse yourselves.
Yeah.
And let's talk about when the... I mean, how long did that last before people actually started to notice that your humour was like that? At what point did the upper echelons start to have a word with you?
It was quite a long time, really, but it was only really... Yeah. They only reacted to when there was stuff, other, you know, things in the paper or something.
Well, it was,
people would occasionally phone in.
The Wrapped Over Sick video games joke. That was... Because I remember the features editor rang me up at home on a Saturday and she was going through digitizer with a fine-tooth comb and just checking every little thing with me. And I remember there was a bit on there about, I don't know what the feature was, but there was a line about how there was a fault with the Mega Drive and how Noel Edmonds would materialise in people's houses. and I remember her saying, is this true? Is this a parody? I was like, bless her. She was a lovely... ish lady.
She was alright.
She was alright.
Was it true in the end?
Actually, that's the funny thing.
Yeah. The funny thing is,
I can believe that.
So she rang me out, and is this parody?
Because the Mega Drive had blast processing, so I can imagine that would be it would be able to do that.
Edmund's processing.
So this had more graphics, but the Mega Drive had blast processing. Okay,
that'd be it.
When was that? What month and year are we talking?
That was fairly early on, but that was sort of the start of us kind of getting this slightly iffy reputation, but
it came and went, didn't it?
It did, also Karen Reed, the same person that rang me up checking that Noel Edmonds hadn't materialised in people's homes. Also, I remember her, because I think they'd had some disastrous kind of figures for lots of the section, and I remember her coming up to us and describing us, she's hilarious now, as the saviours of teletext. Because we were the only section that was kind of considered some sort of success at that point. I mean, God, it was all downhill from there.
Do you think part of the reason they kind of ignored you was because, or didn't scrutinise it too closely was because it was about video games and they felt they wouldn't really get what you were talking about, or were there other reasons?
Yeah, I mean, it was, yeah, why would they think we were going to kind of put up Danny Torres with a big erect penis for a week? You know, why would they think that? You know, it's just not the dumb thing, especially not on teletext, is it? You know, of course, I think if I was in their position, I probably would have thought, oh, they're going to play it safe. But,
Well, if you put it in, from their point of view, if they're having to sort of say things like, the Noel Edmonds stuff, is that real? So that you think, I can't believe I had to ask that question. So they probably think, like, is this, what does this stuff mean? Oh, God, I'm going to make a twat of myself. I'm going to ask a really embarrassing question, so I'll just let it all slide. So a lot of that went on, yeah. But then every so often there would be some flare-up and some complaint or something, and then there'd be, you know, sort of 2 weeks, a month or something, and everything being gone through and needless things being kind of taken out for which weren't... Not, and of course, they invariably would miss all the stuff that was actually really offensive.
Yeah, they always miss the dodgy stuff. I remember one time, it was a Friday afternoon, we used to put up the fake ads at the weekends, I think. And I remember one of the subs, there were two Emmas. Okay, one of the subs came over. We'd done this ad, and I remember it was an ad for something called French Book. And it was all kind of, it was a French phrase book, it was just nonsense. I remember there was nothing dodgy in it at all. She came over, she'd obviously had a long day of kind of like subbing everything for the weekend, and she just went, look, I'm just taking it down. I cannot be bothered to kind of do it. There's this kind of broken look in her face. There was a lot of them just not taking any risks. Yeah, my favourite one was after you were gone, when the guy who eventually became Teletext's last editor rang me up. I was irate at the time because there was a paragraph that instead of kind of asking me to change this paragraph because I don't know what he'd read into it, he just deleted the paragraph, so this page no longer made sense. He became the editorial director. But he rang me up and he had a go at me because there was a bit about linking to the index page which said finger the index. And I said to him, I'm sorry, what's the problem with that? It's a pun on index finger. And they're like, do I have to spell it out? You know, fingering? And it was like, you know, and it wasn't even intended as that. And I do think the early reputation that we got, it did get kind of blown out of all... Sorry, I'm sounding like I'm defending myself. I don't care. Yeah, I'm glad we got the reputation we did because we've endured as a result. But certainly, I know that sub-editors, when they brought in new people, would get warned to keep an eye on Digitizer.
I still can't believe it because some of the stuff you were getting away with then was just the whole zombie Dave stuff. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe that they would like to. Yeah, that's fine. Someone's basically saying, like, you know, anyway, whatsoever. All the worst words possibly imaginable in a really thinly veiled way. And like, yeah.
Right, I just went off the deep end once you went. You were the last.
Exactly. Yeah. That was him. Yeah.
Well, so speaking of that, so that brings us to your final days. And if I were just to say Sony PR, maybe you could start to tell us the story of the how it all began to fall apart, and then also your
final that's your microphone battery thing.
That's what I'll pick up. You keep chatting.
Your spectrum prolapsing.
It was. That nice gentleman that was on the screen earlier, Mr. Dave Perry, I think it was. Before it was he, yeah. So what happened was, you know, we used to have, even though I say we were outsiders and everything else, but we did have a couple of, friends on the inside who would phone us up with little bits of industry. We had to fill this stuff in every day. I'm not the magazine, but a news page was there, so we'd have all the stuff in there. And this insider said, Dave Perry's about to be sacked.
But I was off on paternity leave at the time, my youngest daughter.
Yes. No, I'm sorry. I'm because you remember these things better than I do. I know you weren't there. I know it's completely my fault.
No, it wasn't because the knives were out for a long time.
It was by this stage. I can't even remember what the previous incidents were, but this was this was final warning. And what were they? I mean, obviously.
Well, okay. Well, there was upsetting Sony's PR guy. I don't even remember. What was Glenn that? O'Connor. We upset him because he wouldn't send us a copy of Wipeout.
Wouldn't he send you a copy of Wipeout?
He hated us. I don't know, he wasn't like replying to us. It was like biggest game in the PlayStation launch title, I think. He was just ignoring us.
Just wondered what reason. Oh, he just ignored you.
Until we kind of slagged him off on screen.
But that was typical, wasn't it, as well, in general, of people would just that's what the PR was like back then, that's what it was, wasn't it? People would just...
It was quite, yeah. It was cliquey. Yeah. The games industry back then was incredibly cliquey. Mm-hmm. And particularly it always felt like it was the CMVG guys and,
Well, they would do. They would say, we'll give you the first copy, but obviously the understanding is you'll give us a fantastic good review.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we, we were never ever in that kind of. Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did you not give good review, you actively slagged off, I believe, the Sony Power Minister.
Well,
is that right?
I can't remember the details of what we actually said.
We said it's bad PR, O'Connor.
Oh, that's right.
We wrote a whole article about how he couldn't get a copy of Wipeout, and then he just immediately rang up the second it went to air because I think we were frustrated because that was the mistake we made. Instead of kind of putting it in the usual thing, we just put it up that afternoon without running it by the editors, which that was like a no-no because you had to,
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that went down.
We just put it up and within seconds. Then there was various things. You remember there was that magazine that. We slagged them off online on air, and we described them as irrelevant. And the guy rang up demanding a copy of the page. And said, I've got to sue you. It was like
some magazine, was it?
Kind of like one of those.
I do remember somebody else.
Not one of the good ones. it was one of the irrelevant ones.
I do remember thinking around that time. It was like, well, actually, clearly now everyone isn't reading it.
Clearly. He wasn't reading it closely enough because we changed the word irrelevant. Or irreverent, to irrelevant, that was it. We changed irrelevant to irreverent when we sent it in the photocopy of... So we made him think he'd misread it.
Encoded into his VHS tapes, you see.
Say, Tim, isn't that absolutely fascinating? But on the one hand, the industry is saying, digitizer doesn't matter, it's only print that matters. But at the same time, you say something like this and immediately they're on the phone. So it must have mattered really to them. Otherwise they would just go,
I suppose slagging off a PR man's ability to do PR by name.
Yeah.
I can kind of see why he might have had an issue.
If you work in PR, you deserve it.
Yeah.
So that led to a training day in which you... Paul had a bit of a revelation about how the industry saw you. There was a particular mention of the royal family.
Yeah, well, this was you were still there, I think, because it was after the It's Bad PR O'Connell incident. It's Bad PR O'Connell gate. And, because Tim wasn't actually an employee of Teletext. You were freelance, weren't you?
I was a volunteer.
Bless.
Yeah, I was freelance and on any event at the office 3 days a week, actually.
Yeah, so you didn't have to go on these stupid training days, basically. No. So I had to, because I was officially an employee. And we had this training day, which was, the idea was the morning would be kind of general journalistic guff, and then the afternoon we'd go around London in a taxi, kind of trying to find policemen to wear their hats. I'm not kidding, that was like the sort of nonsense we had to do, like team building. I spit my trousers that day. I had to buy some new ones. But in the morning, we were given this conundrum of, what would you do if the entire royal family, were wiped out in a skiing accident? And the first person to speak up went, check digitizer to check they've not put any jokes on. And then everyone else went, yes. That's the number one thing we were going to do. So by that point, we were screwed. The entire company thought, that I was, the first thing that we would do in the event that they were all killed was like a man's daddy joke. It's like, quick question, what is the funniest thing in the world? Answer, all the royal family being killed in a skiing accident.
That's true.
We did bring it upon ourselves, but there was a degree of it kind of, it was kind of Chinese whispers and it getting inflated by...
But by the way, I'm not sure if we actually found out, Violet, the date that you actually started writing for Digi. It wasn't right at the beginning, but
it was after we'd been to LA together, was it? Or before? No, it was before then. It was before then.
Yeah. We'd done Norway.
Norway.
Norway was kind of the first trip. It sounds very jet set, don't we? Norway, LA, that was it.
There was too much money in this industry.
Yeah, there was. Both of those, you got us on. They weren't going to invite us
Exactly, and I picked up on that, and because I was obviously quite recognisable on the TV and all the rest of it, and got a bit well, more of an ear, I would just sort of say to people, oh, why don't you ask the digitizer people? They're really nice, they're really nice. Oh, I might come, but what about the digitizer people? And then they would have plenty of seats to fill, if you saw what I mean. It was just reminding them that you existed, really. Yeah.
LA, the truth, though, LA was good, though,
but LA
it?
Was a different, it was a case, wasn't it? Because LA was a really weird one that I...
You just asked.
Well, there had been a TV producer that had made a show, which we talked about earlier, called Head to Head over the giant revolving brain. And there was a 3D version of it as well. And he was actually a complete genius, as you can tell by that format I've just described, and was snapped up by Virgin Games. And he went over to the Children's Channel in London and went off to work at Virgin Games in LA. And he was like, you know, I heard from him, oh, it's amazing here, we're doing these amazing games with Clive Barker and this, that and the other. And it felt like the new frontiers, you know, in LA of gaming, and oh, now we were 16-bit and it was going to get even better. And he said, I'd love to show you like the stuff we're working on, because he understood sort of the value of, having someone from the TV industry looking into it rather than magazines. And he kind of persuaded Virgin over there that they ought to have me coming over to see it. And I said, oh, but there are these other guys in the, in the UK.
What do you remember the Virgin PR people? They were saying, what?
It came from America, didn't it? That was the point. Yeah. It was the American wing of the company. That's how it.
So
that's how they flew us all over there. They got us a hire car and a hotel. And then when we got there, they refused to show us any of their games. Do you remember?
Yeah. We were in the office for a day and a half.
Yeah. They wouldn't show us.
The rest of the time.
Just, having tequila races in the hotel.
Yeah, that was... Yeah.
Why did they refuse?
Well, I think they got us over there because Robert said, oh, we really want to show... And then they kind of went, oh, actually, we've just changed our minds. It's a bit of a secret. And we don't want you to know. But listen, please have a nice time in LA.
Do you remember we had to go and sit in a room with Tommy Tallarico? Does anyone know who he is? He's like a big music guy. And he basically, it was awful. It was like kind of like four of us and Tommy Tallarico. It was really small. It was like a cupboard.
It was a tiny room.
It was a tiny little room, and he just kind of got this rubber tube out like he was going to kind of commit suicide with into an exhaust, and just kind of, we were sat in there while he had to kind of go, he plugged into it. It was awful.
It was supposedly like the hottest nightclub at the time in LA,
wasn't it? Oh,
there
was that
it?
As well, yeah. No, that
was
no.
A different place.
Oh my goodness!
Was a Tommy Tallarico place another?
No, he was at Virgin. Tommy Tallarico was at Virgin in a cupboard with a tube that he used to blow into, and people would go in and watch him for a bit, and then kind of leave, going, "That was weird." There was that nightclub with the stone that opened up.
Oh, that was Bernie somebody's nightclub. Torpin?
No, it was ELO guy, Jeff Lynn. He was sat there.
Okay.
He was
there. Sorry.
Sorry.
Drop some
more names.
Yeah. Yeah.
You pissed up Clive Barker's house. Do you remember that?
No.
Because you really needed a way, because we were going to see if Clive Barker was in. Because this guy knew Clive Barker, and he wasn't in.
To me.
Well, yeah, but you were like, I'm sorry, I really need a way. I'm going to go and do a way over there. And it was happened to be Clive Barker's house.
Oh, that's right.
I remember putting the car lights on while you were doing it.
See, I think it'd be very sort of easy and hack to ask a question like, where did you get your crazy ideas from the jokes? But I think that when your life is pissing on Clive Barker's house and dropping whoopee cushions on...
John Leslie.
Yeah. I feel like, actually, it will probably seem quite normal. I think it is probably a very alternative lifestyle that you were living.
I don't know, really.
It did seem bizarre at the time. It didn't seem like a normal day. In the life of
it was never
anything.
Yeah, it was a mad kind
it
of...
It also, exactly, it felt very unsustainable. So in the end, when I did get sacked, it was like, well, yeah, that was always coming. It seemed like the whole adventure was bound to end kind of in some dramatic way quite soon. Mm.
In regards to your writing, Violet, did you, knowing the style of Digi, did you just sort of write what you wanted from the heart, or did you try to emulate a style? Tell us about that.
Well, I guess the first thing to say about when you wrote for Digitizer that no one would really consider until you're faced with the task of doing it out of the blue is that sort of, is it like 160 characters per page thing? or whatever it is, which really restricts in the first place how you can write anything.
Was there a limit to the number of pages you could
Well, I was
have?
Asked to write, I think, 5 or 6 pages, something like that. But the point with just sitting there, and you know that you've got, like... What's weird is that also you know that when people watch it, you don't know what page they're going to start on. You don't know, they might come in the middle of page 3. Now, you guys probably just got used to just thinking, like, how you were writing it, because that's how you were writing everything, but... It was kind of like you couldn't sort of have half a thought by the end of the page and then continue it over the page because it just wouldn't make sense. Mm. So you had to kind of think of everything in little kind of bite-sized chunks that would sort of fit, which is now how everybody writes for the internet because you're thinking in a non-linear way how people might come from any point, read it in any point, and not be completely lost in what they're reading. So I guess I thought when I wrote anything, I thought of it more kind of, you know, logistically, like, how am I going to have a thought that goes across 6 pages that is only in these tiny bite-sized chunks and that people can come across in any order? So that was the first thing I did. And I guess the second thing I did was, obviously, I couldn't, like, emulate Digitizer, and it's a really scary thing to be asked to write for, like, people who you consider your, like, total heroes. So how do you do that, really, you see? This is what I was like when I jumped out from behind the TV at the Nintendo. I can't help it. And so you can't. I think I just... I don't remember particularly having a strategy except to just kind of be... just kind of try and do everything with a little bit of a pinch of salt, I guess.
Yeah.
It fit, though. You know, everything you did, I mean, you know, I was often failing really well with it. I always remember you started, the first page was always kind of a bit funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it felt like then you kind of ease people in. This is not completely different to everything else you get on Digitizer. You talk about the bear quite a lot.
Yes. I did talk about the bear a lot. And so I did try to kind of, obviously, you know, it was like, you know, I wrote it as a fan. So hopefully it did fit in, but it obviously couldn't steal any of the, you know, couldn't start writing... Do you see? In the middle of the, I probably did that a couple of times because it was too tempting. But, so that was my approach to it.
Great.
Yeah.
So we've actually only got 10 minutes left.
Oh, God.
So let's, instead of getting to the end of Digitizer, let's go to some audience questions. We will ask you to put your hand up as well in a bit. We've got a few that you've written down for the people who are a little bit shy. And so we'll read out, we'll just do maybe quick-fire answers to some of these, and then we'll go to the audience for... questions. How about this one? Did you read Game Central, either in its teletext incarnation or more recently on the Metro website?
No.
Now, that was particularly interesting. Is Metro the same, the one on the Metro website?
It's the same guys, I think. But, I don't know. It was no offence to them. A
little bit of offence to them, though.
That was my thing, and I wanted, once I was out of the teletext, I wanted, that was it, I was done. You know, I didn't want to kind of look back.
So I've got one here. Do you have many memories of DigiWorld, the previous revival of Digitizer? I think it was mostly a Stuart Campbell project.
Yeah, it was. he was really, he got really pissed off at me, but bless him, we've made it up since. But he wasn't happy, because I don't know, I think I'd vaguely promised to do an article once a week for it, and then I didn't think it was happening, and then it kind of happened.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, no, I don't have many memories of it, because I wrote one thing for it.
we've got one here. Just wanted to share this one because I think you see why I want to share this.
Oh, right.
Actually, what it is cock and balls. What's interesting, it's a very tiny penis as well, which I think is interesting. Like, they had the option to draw a big one, but... Well, the balls are of different sizes. And so I think maybe we can spend the last 10 minutes talking about this.
I'm the big ball, by the way.
Sorry?
I'm the big ball, that's right.
You're the big ball, nice.
Billy Big Ball.
Yeah.
Ball.
Tim has only got one ball. Tim. So we've got, if Mr. T was no longer wanted, would he be a has-been?
Come on.
I think that's probably hello, this is Sean Murray of indie developer Hello Games. I would like to license a procedurally generated version of Digitizer whereby I would promise new content daily but instead deliver the same reviews in a different colour. Are you up for this? How much would the licence cost?
Poor Sean Murray, eh? He's become the new Molyneux. What happened?
Well, speaking of that, we've got a regular one here, and I'm really interested to know if this is real. Has anyone you respect ever been appalled by something you did on Digitizer? And that is from Stuart N. Hardy.
Hey.
So is that really Stuart?
No.
Was that a comedy yes or a real yes?
He doesn't exist.
Did you make him up?
No, he does exist.
But it was just a generic name. Oh, is that true? I didn't know that.
He used to write to all sorts of magazines and things. Like, just kind of, you could open up any magazine in Britain for over the space of 10 years, and there'd be a letter by Stuart N. Hardy. Yeah, I'm not even kidding. You know, he wasn't like a Digitizer fan. He was like, I think he just literally read everything and wrote to them.
Wow.
What was the question?
Has any respect ever been appalled by something?
Yeah, probably. You've probably been appalled by things we've done, haven't you?
No.
Okay.
Amused.
Well, there's a couple of people here who were slightly offended by some of the content of that advert. Or the first advert, the Roman Thomas one.
Was it?
Well, you were a bit. You had reservations.
Yes, I was. I thought it was a strong meat with the dog lady action, but there we are.
Well, if you go and watch the original YouTube video, she's laughing.
It was funnier when I was when it wasn't like right in front of my face and on my own computer screen, so I didn't feel that somehow I was responsible. I was sitting back over there watching it on a big telly, so everyone else, it was fine.
Yeah, see, there you go. I actually, after all those years, I managed to write something that offended two.
Tick. So we've got 5 minutes left. Has anyone here got any questions that you'd like to ask now?
Hello.
What's your name?
Gary.
Hello, Gary.
Hello. Without modern day analytics, obviously working with techniques as you were, when you decided to introduce a new character, or Pat Sow or the Snakes or whatever, what made you decide, like, yeah, this is we'll go with Pat Sow, we'll stick with the Snakes. What made you go with the
there is never any thinking through it. It's like that's how I tend to write. There's no planning. It always comes from just in the moment. So I don't know. Draw a picture of a pig. We've got some. Yeah. Fat Sal came about because we wanted a kind of opinion bit at the start of the site to kind of just generate letters because we weren't getting enough letters at the start. So we thought if we write something controversial, we don't have to attribute it to ourselves. We'll attribute it to a pig. So, I don't quite know why it was big, but I don't know why anything. You know, why Gossie the dog was a dog. You know, or the man with the chin, limb chin, was him, or any of these things. You know, it was just in the moment, I'd draw a funny picture and then we'd kind
did
of
did you
come
consider
up
yourself a comedy writer in any way, or did you think yourself a journalist?
Well, neither, really. Some bloke that wrote Digitizer.
You are a script writer now.
Yeah.
And at what point did you at any point through Digitizer think, oh, I'm producing comedy, I am a comedy writer?
No. I mean, we were in our latter days writing comedy at work, because when we decided, we're too good for this medium, we need to break out, so we started writing stuff in the office that was actually kind of sitcom scripts and so on, but no, not really. It was literally just to entertain ourselves. Any of the
well,
funny it was, stuff.
We were comedy writers insofar as we were making each other wee with laughter. That was
So we've probably got time for one more question, and then I'll have a final one. And then hello, what's your name?
David.
Hello, David.
So you probably received a lot of weird letters from people who gave a sense of humour or wanted to threaten you about Sonic 3 or the Amiga. But what was the one, like, the letter that stands out the most?
The one that was covered in human feces. I'm not even kidding. You remember?
I was going to say the one when that bloke just sent a picture of his girlfriend with her top off.
Oh, yeah. Polaroids, weren't they?
Yes.
And then you drew that out in teletext graphics. And
No, they went missing from the office. We'll gloss over that. We got a letter from this guy. He'd increasingly been sending stranger and stranger letters. And he entered, we had a competition called Brown Trumpet at one point, where people had to send in a picture of themselves.
Definitely not asking for trouble there.
Picture of themselves holding up a sign saying digitizer equals filth, and he'd sent us a picture of himself in Debenhams with his trousers down. And holding up a sign. Yeah, he didn't win. But gradually, and then he started writing these letters about how digitizer was like an eye that was spying on him. And, I mean, clearly, issues. And we got this letter one day which... Basically, there was no start and end to it. It was just like a stream of consciousness. There was no, like, dear digitizer, or it hadn't been signed. It was just words. And, yeah, it was smeared in feces. So we went to the police about that.
Which one of us do you think he is? Yes.
I think it was that murder on the Orient Express. It was all of you.
So let's round this off by finding out what you are all up to nowadays. Tim, let's start with yourself.
Well, you gave me very generously gave me a nice plug when
first bought on. There's still some copies left, I think.
I think that's it, actually. Unless you paid for that.
Yeah,
no,
I did.
You did?
Oh, screw you.
Yeah.
out next week.
It's out on Thursday, so there's that. So, yes, travel writing, really. That's my thing.
Sorry.
it's the letter writer.
Does Craig physically exist still?
Yes.
He does?
Yes.
In your possession? Or?
No, not in my possession. Sorry. But somebody actually got in touch with me.
I'm sorry if I don't understand what that means.
This is an Austin Maestro, which I bought to drive around all the worst places in Britain.
I did know that, yes.
Well
yes,
done.
Of course.
I'm a chef, you bought it.
Really?
Yeah,
all that. I'm sorry about that. Yes.
So, yeah,
someone got actually tweeted me the other day saying that they'd seen it in, I can't remember where it was, but it was the same car. Black Austin Maestro, yeah.
I thought it'd be in your garage, though. So.
If I had a garage, it would be in it, but I don't, so it isn't. Yeah.
Violet, I beg your
pardon. Sorry, it's
right, it's all quite informal. Violet, what are you up to nowadays?
I write films and games and interactives. For public spaces.
Ooh.
Looking blank. So basically it all came together for me because I'd worked in TV and I'd worked in video games and so forth, and now I write only very short ones, so for like exhibitions and museums and experiences and things like that, and it's a lot of fun.
Fantastic. Presumably you're on Twitter so people can find out about that, and you are as well, Tim?
I am.
Brilliant. So look them up. And Paul, I don't know if you're on Twitter or not. I don't know. Which, and of course, let's end with yourself, Paul. What's your... Of course, the show's 2000, but what other work would we be able to look at yours recently?
Mostly write films about dance and dogs.
Yeah, so we can get onto that. That's probably what you're best known for.
Yeah, that's it.
Fantastic. My name is Chris Coltrane. If you like left-wing political comedy, search my name on YouTube. If you don't. It's as simple as that, really. It's up to you. Also, I do a YouTube gaming show called Comedians Play Games, where we mainly play Super Mario Maker. So give that a look. Or, again, don't. I literally don't care. If you come and chat with everyone after. I guess we'll have a 15-20 minute break now.
15 minute, yeah.
We'll do 15. However long it takes you to buy beer, that's how long
we'll
break.
Buy some beer, you'll need it.
And then we will have the quiz. My friends, please give a big round of applause to Tim, the Fire, and the Paul.
There's a place where Hollywood-style glamour and the pants-spoiling care of the supernatural meet. I'm Gujan John, and welcome to the Gujan John Celebrity Ghost Hotel. The only hotel where even the toast is a ghost and your daddy is in the toast. At my Celebrity Ghost Hotel, everything is a ghost.
Don't take my word for it.
My name is Benji Coleslaw. That's not my real name. At the Celebrity Ghostel, everything is a ghost. The chairs, the drapes, the grapes, and the thermometers. They're all ghosts.
The Ghostel is the only haunted hotel with over 9,000 celebrity spooks. While staying at the Ghostel, why not get a ghostly makeover here in our haunted enthusiasm? Or just go nuts and smash up some of our stuff. The Gujan John Celebrity Ghostel, anything goes, and I do mean anything. Most of our human staff are too cowardly to stop you, even if you tried to bite them. Bite them, bite them, bite them, bite them. And I should know. Gujan John Celebrity Ghostel is the number one supernatural vacation destination in the nation.
And your daddy is a crustacean.
Is a crustacean.
Stay away from our bins!